And welcome to Worm's Eye View Grassroots News. I'm one of your hosts today, Peter Driftmeyer, and I'm joined by...
Joanna Wang. Nice to meet you guys.
Joanna Wang, how have you been?
Pretty good, thank you.
Right on. It's going to be a great show today. Lots of good tunes. And the two main items we'll be looking at is recently the United Nations passed the... a declaration declaring water and basic sanitation as human rights, and we'll be speaking to someone from the Council of Canadians, that's Mira Karunanathan, and we'll be hearing from her shortly. And then what's your item about, Joanna?
My songs?
About your piece.
Oh, it's about a tuition fee.
Great. And then it's a bit more of an SFU perspective.
Yes, it is.
It'll be great to hear. But for now, we're going to hear a song by Jeremy Ledbetter and Cane Fire with the track Little Bell. Thank you. late July, the United Nations passed a historic resolution to recognize water and sanitation as human rights. The historic precedent, however, was attempted at earlier times in the United Nations, with countries such as Canada voting against it. This time around, 122 countries voted for the resolution, and 41 abstained, including Canada. I'm joined on the phone by Meera Karunanandan. Meera is the national water campaigner with the Council of Canadians, which is one of the main Canadian groups pushing for this resolution at the international level and fighting to change our government's position. Hello, Meera.
Hi. So I should just kind of in introducing the resolution itself, I should probably just clarify that this was actually the first time that a resolution or on the right to water was brought before the General Assembly, but the right to water has been discussed at other key UN meetings where Canada has either voted against or opposed in other ways, worked behind the scenes to undermine attempts to have water recognized as a human right at other levels, for example at the Human Rights Council, where a resolution was presented by Germany and Spain, and Canada was instrumental in watering down the language, pardon the pun, but so that it removed any reference to water as a human right. So this was really, this was the first time where all countries got to pay, take part in the discussions and also participate in a vote at the level of the General Assembly on water and sanitation as human rights.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. It is the UN level is very complicated in all of its different components.
It is.
Welcome to CGSF and congratulations on the victory.
Thank you.
Can you paint us a picture of the water problems in Canada that the Council of Canadians organizes against?
Well, specifically with regards to, we work on a number of different issues. We work on the national level and the provincial level and also at the municipal level. So at the national level, we're fighting for recognition of water as a human right. We're fighting for also a national water policy in Canada. We don't have very strong legislative protection at the federal level of our water resources. We don't have an adequate national water policy. The policy that exists is outdated, decades old, and predates things like the North American Free Trade Agreement. Predates any understanding of the impacts of climate change or any of the kind of mass industrial kind of pollution that we're seeing today, like in the tar sands, we need to update a new national water policy to address many of the issues we're dealing with, also to address threats to have to export water as a commodity to the United States. There's there has been consistently proposals and attempts to have water exported in bulk to the U.S. We don't have a federal ban on bulk water exports. We don't recognize, First Nations and Aboriginal treaty rights with regards to water in many areas where water resources are being destroyed by mining corporations or other extractive industries like in the tar sands. We are allowing mining companies to dump toxins directly into our lakes and rivers through a loophole in the fisheries, a recent loophole that was added to the Fisheries Act, which remains our strongest piece of federal legislation when it comes to the protection of water resources. And we're also calling for provincial recognition of water as a human right, calling for protection of public drinking water systems. So we're calling for a national water and sanitation infrastructure fund. We're calling on the federal and provincial governments to fund public water and sanitation systems. We're seeing a growing trend towards privatization, or at least at the federal and provincial level, we're seeing governments impose, and this is the case in BC, and also at the federal level, where it's become part of the funding criteria for municipal governments who require provincial or federal funding for water and sanitation systems. They're required to explore private-public partnerships as an option. So, lots of problems at many levels that we deal with at the national campaign. But essentially, we're calling for the recognition of water as a human right and as a public resource. We're calling for public control and operation of public drinking water and sanitation systems. We're calling for the recognition of Aboriginal and treaty rights when it comes to in general, but also recognition that First Nations communities, that Indigenous communities, tend to experience to bear the brunt of environmental destruction in Canada, that they are the first to feel the impacts of large scale destruction of water resources, like in the tar sands and elsewhere. Calling for the federal government to address the gap in access to drinking water and sanitation on First Nations reserves. So working with a number of other groups on that. We do have our work cut out for us in Canada.
No, yeah, the list goes on, hey?
Yeah.
So why did Canada earlier, push back against those other UN resolutions in those other UN committees to have water recognized as a human right?
Well, I mean, it's unclear because none of their explanations are very strong in terms of, they talk about exposing Canada to the threat of bulk water exports, when we've argued that it's very clear in the language of the resolution that this would be a commitment between a country and its own population, so it wouldn't force us to export water in bulk in order to address the needs of other communities outside boundaries of Canada. We think perhaps it has to do with this federal government seeing water as a commodity, and wanting we know that Canada is negotiating at the moment a trade deal with the European Union in which water and sanitation systems are on the table. European companies will have greater access or the rights of European companies operating water and sanitation systems will be protected under this trade agreement. So Canada, we have a federal government at the moment that is more inclined to protect corporate and commercial interests than it is the interests of the general public.
Now, defining the human right to water and the human right to sanitation is obviously just one of those steps in that agenda you had listed for me earlier. But how would this motion itself actually translate it into action-oriented work on the ground to ensure communities safe access to water and sanitation?
Well, it's a significant victory that the that the UN now recognizes water as a human right. So it's a significant moral victory and a symbolic victory for those of us who have argued for a very long time that water is a human right. In countries like Canada, it makes our case stronger, where the government doesn't recognize water as a human right, that there's an international commitment now to have water recognized as a human right. It would also mean that the UN, it will be, that it'll be a priority for the UN, that that the means and mechanisms of the UN may be employed in order to monitor and better understand the situation globally. But on the other hand, we've made it very clear too that there needs to be on the ground at the domestic level, the measures need to be in place to implement this resolution on the right to water. So in Canada, it'll mean having strong federal and provincial legislation, because water is shared between the provinces and the federal government, that there be strong provincial and federal legislation to recognizing water as a human right and implementing measures to ensure that all people everywhere have equal access to safe, clean drinking water and sanitation without discrimination.
And how close are we to convincing the government to pass that kind of national water policy you're describing?
Well, I mean, it's been difficult with the Conservative government. On the other hand, we've seen seen opposition parties have all in some form or other expressed this as an important priority. The NDP most definitely recognizes water as a human right. The Liberal Party membership voted 2 years ago to have water they voted on a resolution to have a national water policy that recognizes water as a human right. We have strong indications from the Liberal Party. In fact, very clear indications from the Liberal Party that they support. They supported the resolution at the UN, and so with the Conservative government, we've gone nowhere, but we've made important progress with opposition parties, we are going to put some pressure on provinces as well. And I think, if it happens at that level, it'll already be a fairly huge victory here in Canada, because provinces play such an important role in drinking water and sanitation.
And so Canada's abstention in that vote, how does this influence Canada's individual policy course? Does it at all, or will the new UN recognition of water as a human right influence our own policy?
Sorry?
Will the recognition of water as a human right at the UN level, even though Canada abstained in the vote themselves, will that resolution still have an impact on our own policy, or
domestic policy, the resolution itself cannot force governments to adopt any specific policy measure. On the other hand, it gives us momentum as a movement to hold our governments accountable to this international commitment, it gives us the fact that the majority of the world, 122 countries representing over 5 billion people, have supported a measure to recognize water as a human right. It gives a lot more weight to our call for water to be recognized as a human right, and we're, you know, we're seeing more and more groups step up, you know, as I mentioned earlier, other political parties stepping up to criticize the Conservative government's abstention, and increasingly Canada will be isolated, and the Conservative government will be isolated in its refusal to recognize water as a human right. And so we're hoping that at some point the will of the general public, we've done polling in Canada as well, and the majority of Canadians would like to see water as a water recognized as a human right, will, that the will of the people will prevail, and that we will see some movement in that direction.
Let's talk a little bit more about the movement, the grassroots movement for water justice. Just to get to this victory, what kind of strategizing do you feel it took to win it?
Well, it took decades of, or at least a decade of the water justice movement highlighting at international forums that water needs to be recognized as a human right, rejecting. I mean, and this emerges out of a movement that rejected efforts to privatize water systems in the global south, and many successful efforts to privatize or successful victories against efforts to privatize water in the global south, that many felt that the right to water was a key element, the recognition of water as a human right was a key element in moving forward in that struggle. We've seen countries adopt water as a human right at the domestic level as a result of the global water justice movement and their work, and I would say this resolution, I mean, it emerges out of government, the Bolivian government, that first one of the countries that very strongly rejected water privatization in Cochabamba, someone who it came from an ambassador, the ambassador, the UN ambassador to Bolivia, who was very much involved in that struggle, who considers himself part of the global water justice movement, and felt that as a member of the global water justice movement, or as an activist within that movement, with a certain amount of political power, that he felt compelled to take that that message or that call to action to the UN, and in the end was fairly successful in convincing his fellow governments to vote in favor of the resolution. So, several meetings where the international water justice movement has converged. The Bolivian and many other governments have been meeting with activists for the past several years, and so a lot of the strategy, the messaging, came out of the work of global water justice activists. Now we would like to see implementing measures. There's a lot more we would like to see. We would like to see this become a tool in our battle against water privatization. But this is an important first step.
And now that the first step is taken, where do you see, strategically speaking, where do you see the movement going here in Canada to get those water policies you're talking about?
Government. It'll be a question of we will need to come together as a movement to hold our government accountable. We we'll need to see a a right to water bill presented at the parliamentary level, at the federal level. We actually at the Council of Canadians have a draft water bill that we're hoping will pass at the federal level. We're pitching it to provincial governments, so we'd like to work with groups working on water issues at the provincial level to help promote stronger or promote legislation recognizing water as a human right.
Great, and how can people get involved in that fight?
Well, they can look at our website, www.canadians.org. We have a number of different resources and tips on how to get involved. They can support. We also have a project at the community level called the Blue Communities Project, where local activists can call on municipal governments to recognize water as a human right. And there's a guide you can download off our website called the Blue Communities Guide. We have postcards calling for on the federal government to recognize water as a human right, so people can participate in our postcard campaign or letter writing campaign. We have an electronic action alert that people can send, or you can just generally get involved in the Council of Canadians and get involved in our bigger struggle for water justice by getting involved in one of our 70 local chapters across the country, or form your own chapter, and you'll find out how on at www.canadians.org.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Meera Karunanandan. Meera is the National Water Campaigner with the Council of Canadians. And as she said, if you'd like more information on the Council's work, you can visit www.canadians.org. And you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we're broadcasting here from Burnaby. Today's show is Worm's Eye View Grassroots News.
Sure. And that was Brassernaut with their song Fan.
My name is Joanna. I'm so glad that I was interviewing one of students who is receiving scholarship at SFU. Her name is Natalie Gan. We talk about the issue of tuition fees being higher and higher. Hope you guys enjoy it.
My name is Natalie. I am a fourth year student up at SFU. I'm doing a double major in dance and international studies. Just in terms of paying for this fall, I realized that I'm actually paying more for this semester than I ever have. And I have a feeling it has, not only has the tuition fees been hiked as has been a consistent trend in the last 10 years, but also that I think a lot of the small school fees are also being hiked, whether or not we know it. So I think in the accumulation of all those, of every single fee being raised, means that really I'm looking at more than $3,000 for this semester, which is a bit of a shocker. Also, it makes it difficult because doing a double major, I was getting open scholarships for the last couple of years, and those are based on GPA, and so they help you out if you've got good academic standing, and they take those open scholarships are the value of it is dependent on how many credits you're taking, but after a certain number of credits, they no longer offer that open scholarship, which means that not only is this semester the most expensive semester I've ever experienced, but I'm also going to be going into it with acknowledging that I cannot expect any awards or scholarships, at least ones that I'm usually used to getting. So that makes for kind of a scary scenario. It's going to be definitely a couple of hard times this semester, which is why I've always, in terms of throughout my entire school career, I've always done a part-time job. And I know a lot of students who do full-time jobs alongside almost full-time school, which is really, it takes a toll on you. It's really amazing what students do to get through their academic career. It's really astounding, and it's actually really unfortunate, because I think having to juggle so much on your plate really hampers your ability to get the most out of your schooling, out of your education, and so much of it is a recurring attitude among students seems to be, oh, I'm just going to try to get through this. It's about survival, as opposed to really, really just discovering what it is that you want to do in life, discovering what information is out there, just really the value of education. Yeah. What's funny is, because I'm in the arts, it is quite many times I'll tell people, oh, I'm doing a double major in dance and international studies, and the first question will be, what are you going to do with that, and are you guaranteed a job at all once you graduate? And the answer is, of course, no. And I think that is the case with a lot of students, especially in the arts nowadays, where, you know, we do have the option of going to school, we do have that luxury, we do have we're that fortunate to be able to go to school and just to study something that intrigues us, that interests us, without the security that there is a job waiting for us at the end. And so for me, I've just kind of decided that that's not my first and foremost concern. I can go job seeking later, but really what the value of education for me is about opening my eyes to what the world has to offer and what is going on in the world, especially because I'm taking international studies. And I was taking this brilliant course last semester.
What's
Sociology 396 at It was one of those courses that there's a different geographical focus every semester, so depending on what the professor wants to focus on. And basically it was about global political theory, and it was taught by Allison Ayers. Rarely have I come across a course that I've learned and changed so much as a human being. And I just thought this information I could not go without. But you know, it's funny, after the course was over, I thought, what am I going to do with this information? You know, now I can rant about a lot of things, but when will I be able to put that information, transfer that pen to paper? When will someone in my lifetime pay me for that information? Chances are never. Right. Well, not in a monetary sense. And what to me is strange is that a lot in our society is based on value is measured by by money, really. Value is measured by money. So when I think about the value of education, I think about us surpassing all those. Who's going to get a job? When are you going to get a job? And how much is it going to pay you? And instead, I think it's about creating human beings that are competent, capable, are self-driven, are critical thinkers, and well-rounded. And are able to, you know, read, write, and speak the works. And so that way, I think that's how post-secondary has become. It's really about just harnessing skills and passions. And then when you go out into the world, then you go and you know, there's a lot more responsibility on our part to go and seek out where we might find a job.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think school does that anymore for us.
How do you think the value of education?
I think what's funny is nowadays I don't think that's an option, which is why everybody goes to school, whether or not you can afford it, whether or not you want to, whether or not you know what you're studying. Everyone goes to school because it is a prerequisite for this so-called well-paying job that we're all hoping to get.
You mentioned you had a part-time job, and then how do you manage for that, the budget?
I'm very, very fortunate because I live at home, and that makes it so that the money that I make can go towards tuition, can go towards school fees, can go towards eating, as opposed to rent, and also it can go to all the extra classes that I take on the side for dance training, because that is very, very expensive in this city. So in terms of budgeting all of that, fortunately, I don't have to worry about rent. So really, it is about, it's as the student stereotype is, you eat as cheap and little as possible. And then you just load up on the coffee. That's essentially how it goes. And I've always been a very, very good saver, a very good saver of money. I don't, other than my soy chai latte, my fair trade soy chai latte. That's pretty much all I spend money on, really. I'm fortunate to work at a restaurant because that takes care of some food. I'm fortunate to live at home because that also takes care of bills here and there. So I think I sit in a very privileged position to be able to work part-time and know that some of that money can go towards whatever I need it to go to.
How do you usually pay for your tuition fee?
For me, it always tended to be credit or debit. The fact that tuition fees can no longer be paid via credit card, I think, makes it very, very difficult for students. The notion of credit is something I think that's very important for students. You don't always have that much money available all at once. And credit just allows you to take care of something and then just keep working at the same time so that you can, you know, you may not have that money right now, but you will have it later. And I think that is a situation that students find themselves in constantly. The fact that you've got bills to pay, you've got debts here and there, you've got people you owe money to, but you're working at a job, and you know money's coming. Money is always, it will be coming, but you probably don't have $3,000 to hand somebody immediately. So I think it makes it, it probably is a very, very challenging scenario for a lot of students. In terms of not being able to pay by credit card, I think it's very inconveniencing, and it's probably going to make students' lives a fair bit more challenging.
How do you think students can success without degree?
It's very counterproductive, considering schools are supposed to exist for students, and student services are really supposed to be what money is going towards. I think it's a misplacement of value. Again, that notion of value comes up, and value and priorities. I think what is the priority for a university institution? And I don't think it's to rack up revenue and cut costs so that you can have maximum profit. I think it should, and I imagine that all students agree with me, that it really should be a lot more about creating a supportive and nurturing learning environment where all the services that students need are accessible, and where it is acknowledged that students are going to find themselves in a lot of tough financial situations, and that there be as many different ways to support students through that as possible. So I think it's really unfortunate to hear that.
And that was an interview held by Joanna Wang with SFU student Natalie Gan. Now we're going to hear some music by Spanish hip-hop artists. We're starting with Ana Tijoux with the song Partir de Cero.
De cero. Los últimos de la fila luego serán primero. Quién sabe si el villano luego será caballero. El traje solo tapa lo que se encuentra por dentro. Dentro y afuera quemaré mis cartuchos. Sentí la pólvora quemando de mis puchos. De poco a mucho aplastar la mala racha. Si la vida me apunta, mi autoestima se agacha. Cha, 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 cha. Para partir muriendo, salir de los escombros y reírme en mi entierro. Abrace mis demonios cuando querías me siento. Pero el puesto está ocupado, nena, llámate mi miedo. Voy a partir mirándome por esta boca se rima y por esta boca se come. Mi boca con mi rima y ya no hay quien me la controle. Es parte del juego y de mi mejor rol. Oh, luego para partir en quinta. Mi estanque se llena solo cuando le pongo tinta. Ya no freno, solo acelero de forma distinta. Lo que te capacita es la potencia que te habita.
Empezaré del comienzo.
Voy a partir de cero.
Regresar al inicio.
Empezaré del comienzo.
La cuestión de tiempo.
Voy a partir de cero.
Regresar al inicio.
Voy a partir de cero.
Regresar al inicio.
Voy a partir segura. Si no parto segura se romperá mi armadura. La moldura contiene de toda su estructura. Y el contenido decidió matar toda estructura. Pura cepa para partir perdiendo. Perdiéndose valora el detalle de un gran comienzo. Mejor mirada atrás, analizar todo el complejo. Manejo de una industria que solo quiere forcejo. Eso yo lo dejo para partir saliendo. Ya baje demasiado y el sol está naciendo. Se abre mi telón 77 transmitiendo. Voy a partir de cero, cero es mi atuendo. Moviendo mi pieza con un largo enroque. Mi tablero no quiere que a los peones se toque. La reina es uno más de todo este gran reto. Que enfoque, emboque, hasta que no se equivoque. Oh, luego, cabecea la nuca. La batera te marca y la caja te desnuca. Golpe instantáneo directo a la bazooka. Si caduca la onda, es porque ya no suma.
Empezaré del comienzo.
La cuestión de tiempo.
Voy a partir de cero.
Regresar al inicio.
Empezaré
저 하시 date cuenta todo está mal menos tú todo es una mierda menos tú todo se equivoca menos tú pero tú que te crees que eres ¿qué pasa con eso? Todo está mal menos tú todo es una mierda menos tú todo se equivoca menos tú pero tú que te crees que eres Aprietar gatillo, pa' gasinar los bolsillos En momentos de vivir como chiquillo Disfruta que sé que sabe a poco este caramelo de color amarillo Yo dejo abiertas las puertas del castillo Sé que cuesta ser humilde, eso no es sencillo Me han enseñado a gritar, estoy en libertad Vigila que no se te caigan los anillos Todo está mal menos tú, todo es una mierda menos tú Todo se equivoca menos tú, pero tú, ¿qué te crees que eres, mal menos tú, todo es una mierda menos tú, todo se equivoca menos tú, pero tú que te crees que eres, Mi derrame me tiene algo de infame, hablo código, hablo lugares, habla ahora mamona no te calles, enciéndeme tú si crees que sabes, si no escuchas, hace calor en la calle, hace frío en la calle, uno se hace en la calle, dame la información con detalle, no te guardes nada que a mí todo me vale, cae en la cuenta, rompe cristales, dale duro, cogerlo suave, sea que sabe, sea quien sea sabe, que hoy hay hijo pa' comer, hijo tú sabes, que no hay limitación pa' esta hembra, tendrá que ser grande la chispa pa' que me prenda y allá llama, mala recomienda la cuarentena pasarla en la cama. Todo está mal menos tú, todo es una mierda menos tú, todo se equivoca menos tú, pero tú que te crees que eres, le basta con eso. Todo está mal menos tú, todo es una mierda menos tú, todo se equivoca menos tú, pero tú que te crees que eres, Te cuenta.
You've been listening to Worm's Eye View Grassroots News here on CJSF 90.1 FM, and of course, where are we broadcasting from?
SFU Burnaby.
The last song was called Memos 2 from Mala Rodriguez. My name's Peter Driftmeyer.
My name's Preet Burke.
My name is Joanna Nguyen.
Worm's Eye View is a volunteer show. We're always looking for more folks to get involved. And the easiest way to contact us is at our email, wormseyeradio@gmail.com.